This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Well, this week's episode is going to be jam-packed, and we have so much information to share with you. I'm going to get started straight away by first thanking all of the now 1,000 subscribers to our pod letter. Again, I call this a pod letter because it's not just a newsletter. This actually is information telling you about the podcast. And we just this week reached 1,000 people who have now subscribed to the pod letter. And that 1,000th person was Gilmy4. I don't know what the first or last name was, but that's the email address. It was Gilmy4. So congratulations, Gilmy4, for being the 1,000th subscriber to the pod letter. We look forward to more of you subscribing to the pod letter so you too can find out about who's going to be on from week to week and also hearing about great podcasts from our archives that you may have missed or want to hear then again. Also, I want to welcome our newest friends of the Magic Word. We have two new people who have joined this week. I want to welcome Casey Ushijima and Thomas McDonough. Thank you guys for joining the Friends of the Magic Word. And because of your financial pledges that you have made, that helps to defray our ongoing monthly production costs for keeping this podcast going. I thank you very much, KC, for using Patreon.com, and also then, Thomas, for you using PayPal for you to make your monthly pledges to the podcast. Thanks again, and if any of you would like to find out more information about how you too could become a friend of the Magic Word and to learn about some of the pretty cool perks that you get by being a member, all you have to do is go over to themagicwordpodcast.com and click on the tab that says Become a Friend of the Magic Word. There you'll find some information, including a video that I recorded many years ago before my hair turned white and I grew a beard. So it's kind of funny to watch for about a 3-minute video. Also, we are going to have a contest I want to announce right now. We will tell you more information about that on the backside of this podcast, but it will be for a book that was authored by our guest this week, and we will talk about that later, about how that you can enter the contest for a chance to win a copy of this book. And also, we want to do a little bit of cross promotion with our sister podcast, Shazam Pod, Shazam Pod. Shazam Podcast, and the Shazam Pod is going to be having an online convention, and that is with Carissa Hendricks and Kayla Drescher. And I'm going to step aside for a minute and let Kayla tell you in her own words.
Well, hello there. Kayla Drescher here from the Shazam Podcast. I wanted to invite you to our first ever virtual convention, the Online Wonder Gala, taking place April 30th and May 1st from the comfort of your desk, your couch, your hot tub, wherever. The acts booked and activities planned are like you have never seen before. So get your registration and information at shazampod.com/OWG. That's shazampod.com/OWG. See you there.
Thank you, Kayla, for letting us know about this upcoming virtual convention, and I wish you luck on this event, and I also encourage all of you listeners to go and check that out at that website and to register, because it looks like it's going to be some fun with some pretty unique guests. Well, this week, our guest is Mr. Al the Only, who was from Detroit, Michigan, who, with his lovely wife, Lori, had moved to Hawaii. And Al is someone who has worked in the restaurant business as a restaurant performer, as well as trade shows, doing a lot of big corporate events across the country then as well. And, of course, I guess now that he is actually performing and working in Hawaii as well, he is transoceanic. How about that? Just not just in the lower 48, but also, again, into Hawaii as well. Well, anyhow, in this week's episode, he has a lot of really good advice and tips that he will provide us. It has to do with working trade shows and restaurants and some good business tips that are solid. And I know you're going to enjoy. Oh, and also, I forgot, he is the one who is the tour guide for the cemetery tours in Colon, Michigan at the magic graveyard there. And that's something that's a little bit unusual and different, and we could actually do a whole podcast on that, and who knows, maybe in the future we will, but it will talk about that towards the end of this podcast as well. This is chock full of just a lot of information, so I'll step to the side and introduce you to my friend here this week. Please welcome Mr. Al the Only here on The Magic Word. Today I've got with me a longtime friend who is someone actually who has been instrumental in my professional career, and we'll get to that a little bit later in this podcast then as well. And he is not only a good friend, but he's a professional performer, someone you have seen. If you attend the Abbott's get-together each year, you know him as being the person who is if not the curator of the cemetery, at least he's the graveyard host. How about that? I guess my way of putting it. Someone who has been around again for a long time and is just full of a lot of great ideas. I had worked with him so many years ago back in the Magic Menu with Jim Sisti when he was working restaurants and we're going to with Max and Irma's and all kinds of stuff we want to get into and talk about. But before I spoil all that, let me tell you who it is. There is Al the Only. Hey, Al, how you doing?
Aloha. you're making us sound like two old guys, Scott. I remember when we used to drink milkshakes.
That's right. And the soda jerk was really a jerk.
I know. That's why we didn't tip him well.
That's after we finished tipping
hell,
cows.
We knocked them over. Yes. We knocked them over. Anyway. But bump.
Exactly.
God, these jokes are so old, but J. Marshall would be proud of us.
How old are they?
Yeah. They're so old.
So, before we get started, what have you got to drink? You having a little libation of any type?
Well, I just poured myself. Okay, audio audience, all together now. Crown Royal.
Crown Royal. I have, you can maybe hear that there. I've got a little bit of that myself, a little Crown and Diet Coke.
Oh, I know my best friends. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's scary or a happy thing. I've had the pleasure of being hosted at many homes around the country, even by clients.
Yep.
And somehow there's always a bottle of Crown Royal sitting on the counter.
They know
it
you
is
will.
Just, It's flattering, but it's anyway. Let us. I digress.
Well, that's a nice digression to go into. It's kind of like with me. I've gotten to be known synonymous with martinis as well.
Absolutely.
As you have with Crown. Now, did you visit the Crown factory? Didn't you say you went up to Canada and tried to get in, and that they weren't giving tours or something?
Would you like the long story, or would you like the?
Yeah, we got a little bit of time. However long you want to go. I thought it was kind of
one of my dearest friends, Michael Mode, found himself at a magic show in Windsor, Ontario. This is years ago, and he's sitting next to two ladies, and a conversation ensued. You know, why is a single guy at a magic show? Well, of course, hey, that was his buddy on stage, mm-hmm. And well, how about you, ladies? And one of the ladies happened to be an employee of the Crown Royal Bottling Plant in Amherstburg, Ontario. Mm-hmm. And Michael quickly said that his friend has been paying her salary for decades.
Yeah. Surprised your name's not on the check sometimes.
You really? So he asked about tours, and she said, they've stopped giving tours years ago. And I think that's where the comment came in. Well, you don't understand about my friend being your paycheck all these years. Michael Mode got me a private tour of the bottling company.
Oh, my gosh.
So we drove from Detroit, Michigan to Amherstburg, Ontario, which is about a 2.5-hour drive, and we're given a private tour of the bottling facility. The whiskey is not distilled there. That's brought in, I think, from Montreal. But it was fascinating to see how they clean the bottles, how they etch the bottles, the machinery used to put them into the purple bags. And there's mm-hmm. another machine that ties the bags. And the other Crown Royal where the rope is a tassel, they actually have a line. If I recall, about 20 people, each one hand-tying the bags. It was a fascinating tour,
wow.
But there were no free samples, so I was a little disappointed. But yes, I got to see how Crown Royal was poured into the bottles and ready for shipment around the world.
So again, distilled elsewhere, but actually bottled there.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
The booze was brought in by tankers. And then, filled.
You mean railway
the
tankers or on the road? Transport.
I'm guessing they were trucks.
Yeah,
but
I think so.
I wouldn't put it by them. Well, maybe they used rail at one time.
Wow.
But I'm pretty sure these were, semi-tankers.
Have you ever seen those people who have had, like, full jackets and coats made out of the bags?
Oh, yes.
I have enough.
I have enough bags that I could tent a house. Someday maybe I'll have a vest made. I don't know.
I was thinking some years ago of making an egg bag out of a Crown Royal bag and using the crown top of the bottle as being the egg. And I was talking to Robert Bax, and I think actually he had marketed that himself. So I thought, okay, somebody's already done it. I'm not going to recreate the wheel. But did you ever try making one of those? I'm sure it's not an original idea.
I never did. I don't know why I never did. I do know that there is a product on the market that's scarce, if you can find it today. But Joe Stevens had it, and immediately, a half a dozen guys, Joe's got this for sale. By the time I got to it, it was gone.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I do know there's something on the market. I didn't know that Robert was behind it. Maybe it's the same product. Maybe it was different. But no. I never did anything with the bags. I just enjoy what they have inside. Yes.
Exactly. Well, speaking of Michael Mode, I know him being a mutual friend is someone who was best friends also with Jeff Hobson. And the two of them had an app years ago that was a comedy app of joke. It was a joke app, I think, actually, for what used to be before the iPad. What was that? The iTouch or something like that?
Right.
I think, and it kind of had that. But then also he has been working then with the Amish whenever we have our Abbott's get-together, and as far as having chicken dinner and all together and him arranging for us to perform for the Amish and getting buggy rides and all that kind of stuff. He just is a great guy.
Absolutely. Getting back to their comedy, it was a joke app. They have just released it in book form.
I know, really?
It's available on Amazon, and I'm remiss to not knowing the title, but they finally put it out in a book form also.
I like the idea of that as being an app. So this way, if you were someplace on the spur of the moment, basically, of typing in firefighters or something or doctor, you would have a number of jokes that you could read that would be of that genre of whatever you're trying to find at that moment. So I would think having a book, that's one thing, but having an app, I think, would be a little bit better. I'm surprised they didn't advance and bring that forward.
The app was fantastic. It was cross-referenced. You could search it by names, by topics. So the app was very, very well done.
Yeah.
But I'm old enough that prior to that app, I was fortunate to have an app called J. Marshall. I would
the real deal.
The real deal. The past dean of the American Magicians, the one of the better, cheaper acts. Whenever I was working a corporate event, regardless if they were lumber or concrete or you name the industry, I would call Jay, I'm doing this gig. I need a joke. And Scott, I have to tell you, within seconds, Jay had a joke. Now, granted, it may not have been the best joke in the world, but that's the type of mind he had. And then a day or two later, I would get a return phone call from Jay saying, okay, I've got a better one now. All right, I've got a better one now. So Jay was the original app for jokes.
Wow, just a phone call away. That's great.
Yeah.
There are a few people who are just quick like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that is amazing. When you were working those kinds of things, because you lived in and from Hamtramck, and we're also working, Max Nermes will talk about restaurant magic in just a little bit, but also you did a lot of things, I'm sure, for the automotive industry. That had to be one of your bread and butter clients.
Well, the big three, as they were known back in the day, were not so much my clients as their vendors were.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, all the ancillary companies.
Yeah, I did a couple of things for GMC Truck, but I never worked the auto shows as we knew them, as we know them.
Uh-huh.
But
you were never a big Illusion guy, were you?
No, never. I mean, Lori and I, we did a Subtrunk Dollhouse
and a Christmas
zigzag
thing, didn't you?
Yeah. Oh boy, that was always a good season for us. I never considered myself an illusionist. I've always taken the title of general practitioner. I was able to deliver to a client what they requested. So if they needed an illusion, you bet, I was on top of it. If they needed someone to do their cocktail party, that was my forte.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, once I worked for a company that, gosh, this is a long time ago. They basically coated the metal bumpers on the cars. That was what they added to the auto industry. Another time I worked for the company that made all the seat belts. I think it was called General Safety, and companies like that. So never, except for the GMC years, I never worked for the big three directly. But indirectly, there was a lot of auto work. But it was nationwide. I just happened to live in the Motor City at the time.
And they're moving you around, I guess, wherever. For those shows, obviously, wherever they happen to be. Did you ever travel much overseas with any of them?
Never. All my work was always in the 48.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as being taken to a show in Germany or France or any other country in the world, no.
I'm assuming you must have been to some of those car shows and you saw some of the guys work. And who were they who were doing the big illusions at the car shows, like for Ford and Chevy and
well,
all that?
No, but the couple of auto shows. Well, I would go to the auto show every year just to hang out with Carol Fox.
Oh yeah,
and one of the other guys. And one of the other guys who was working it was Mark Sweet.
And then he was Willy Wonka, I think, for a while.
Yep. That was Mark. Mark was from the Detroit area. So every now and then, Carol would have an illusion. It could have been a dagger chest. It could have been an arrowhead, it could have been a hand chopper. I could vaguely recall anything much larger. And that's not to say he didn't do any of that. It's the shows that I was at personally, I didn't see it.
Did you ever see Dick Ryan work?
Oh my gosh, Dick Ryan was a mentor. Dick Ryan,
Bud Dietrich.
I met.
Mm-hmm.
My very first trade show was in 1984. I was working for GMC Truck, and they just put me in the worst possible situation for a show. I mean, I was in the middle of this massive booth. Most of us guys, when we work a trade show, we want to be right on the aisle, and even better, right on the corner of two aisles.
Sure.
And
you probably
that
pay
year
extra
I
for
met,
that too.
Oh, they really do. Mm-hmm. I mean, this thing was like 100 feet by 40 feet.
Holy cow.
Well, we're talking trucks.
Well, of course.
Anyway, at that show was Bud Dietrich, Mike Rogers, and Dick Ryan. And this is my first trade show. Wow.
Wow, indeed.
They just embraced me like an old friend, and towards I think it was a 4-day trade show, possibly six. Dick came up to me, says, "You know, you're a lot better than this. I can tell. I want to talk." And Dick started booking me.
Oh wow!
Became my mentor. So yes, I was very happy. I was able to hang out with those guys, and Dick Ryan was very instrumental in helping me in my trade show career.
Wow, that's a good story. I remember seeing those guys also, and they all had their own styles, and they were amazing. I never saw Carol Fox work at a trade show. I'd seen him perform and knew him quite well at conventions, but never saw him perform outside of Four Magicians, basically.
Yeah. Well, I worked, I think it was a beverage show, and it was either in Los Angeles or in Anaheim. I want to say Los Angeles. There were 12 of us guys working.
Magicians? 12 of the same show?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. This was a huge show. Mm-hmm. So most of us were in different halls, but it was like a little mini magic convention.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like a consumer electronics show. It's a big one for a lot of magicians
same
working
thing.
There, too.
Yeah. Where, all of a sudden you hear that somebody's in Hall C, so on your lunch break you would run over there just to say hi.
Yeah,
that maybe you might be able to meet up for dinner in the evening.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's probably the hardest work. You're on a piece of concrete for 8 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it might have a little bit of padding and a nice carpet, but the trade show itself is very grueling. There's a lot of psychology into it, even more so than the magic. The magic definitely is the draw, but unless you understand that you're not really doing the magic as you are stopping people and trying to convert them to come into the booth to get more information, that's the job.
You got it.
And it just so happens that we use the magic to do the job.
It's a vehicle, exactly.
It's a vehicle, yeah. Dick taught me that, and maybe that's why I was successful with it for as long as I was, because I knew the psychology. The hardest part of the job was the prep, learning the script, finding out about the client, and the hardest part was the prep. The most, what's the right word? I don't want to say tedious, but once you were on the floor, you had a smile plastered on your face. You were wearing a power suit where you looked at least as good as middle management, if not upper management. And I always knew how well I was coming across when after my little pitch, I'll call it a pitch, people would come up to me and started asking me questions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I only knew what I wrote into my script.
Right.
I couldn't tell you the mentions of a product or the idiosyncrasies of a product. So if somebody actually thought that I worked for the company, that I was approachable to ask more questions, I knew I was being effective. Because as soon as they started, I wouldn't actually grab them by the hand, but I would lead them over to, hey, talk to our senior sales representative, Mike, or talk to our senior marketing person, whoever it happened to be. Then that's the way I was able to
try to convert sales. You're right. Yeah. I think that's the greatest compliment whenever they come up and ask you questions about that, because what I have said after a while, I can kind of give them again the pitch and they say, yeah, but I have a question about such and such. And I'll say, well, you need to talk over here to Steve. And they say, well, don't you work for the company? And then I say, well, I am this week.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
You need to talk over to this guy. So this way they quickly realize, oh, yeah, you're not one of the executives. And then another great compliment I love to get is when one of the top brass comes in, the vice president or president comes over and says, you know more about our product than the salespeople know.
Because, I got that too.
Yeah.
Or they're standing in the back looking at the guy who hired me and say, where did we find this guy? It's like,
exactly. Well, I think, Al, the easy thing is for magicians to find that information on the splash page. My idea is if you memorize everything that's on that first page of their website, that's what they want their customers to see first and to know. That's just a quick overview of everything. And that's if you can memorize everything that's on there and understand kind of what it's saying and be able to pronounce the words correctly and everything. And I think you can build magic around those concepts that are on their splash page. Before, when you were talking about in the older days in the 80s and 90s where you had to actually do a lot of research, it was a lot more difficult where they'd have to send you reams of paper and promo material. Then you have to sift through all that kind of stuff. And I'd done that also. And that is quite monotonous and tedious to go through that. Whereas now you just can go and take a look at the page. And it's, I think, a little bit easier from that standpoint. And then from there, try to figure out what is the magic you can wrap around their product basically to attract them. Because again, just as you said, and as Dick told you, the key is it's not about the magic. It's about the product and about the company. Right. And you're trying to get people into the booth to talk to them. They didn't come to see you. They came to talk about the product.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. You nailed it. How many times was I waiting for a FedEx of a ream of magazines and brochures? Mm-hmm. And basically, to streamline it, streamline it. I just went to bullet points. You know, they'll say, and quite honestly, I've never worked for a company that was slower, more expensive, and inefficient. Everybody I've worked for is faster, better, cheaper, and on top of everything that needs to be done in the industry.
No one except Avis was number two.
Good point. That's funny. That's funny. And that's true. So going with that mindset, all you had to do is plug in words, plug in sentences. I'm minimalizing what work had to go into it. Sure. But basically, there was a formula that I used that made it easy for me. Mm-hmm. And I would beat myself. I would script everything I was going to say, and I would beat myself up into memorizing the script, knowing the second I got up into my performance platform, that script was out the window. But I had it so ingrained in me that I knew what I was talking about. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just like you and I having this conversation. None of this is scripted. We're just talking like buddies, which we are. Right. So that's how my pitch. And it's an old Carney term, but it's still a pitch.
Well,
any way you dress up a duck, it's still a duck. So.
It walks like a duck and quacks like a duck. But beyond that, what you were just saying then too, Al, I think I don't want to overlook, and that is of trying to get people into the booth to watch what you're doing. Obviously, you have to track them with magic, and then you talk about the product and everything then too. And there has to be a good even balance of that. But to do that, you learn those kinds of skills, A, working restaurants, and B, working cocktail parties, where you are going up to a new group of people every few moments and trying to convert them into being a lover of you and to your magic and to be interested and invested in wanting to spend their time listening to what you have to say and what you're going to show them. And by learning those skills in those venues, again, restaurants and cocktail parties that you're doing or strolling magic, that's what will transition or translate over into trade shows to being able to attract an audience, I think.
Exactly right. And, you know, this may sound crude, but it's the blatant truth. As soon as we as entertainers realize that we are interrupting somebody's schedule, somebody's time, or somebody's personal space, we will never become the performer or the entertainer or the magician that we feel we are.
You need to respect
because
that.
Because in essence... Mm-hmm. In essence, when you're walking up to a group of people who have a cocktail in one hand and a pen ready to sign a contract in the other hand, we are interrupting part of a business process. If we could transcend that into a, hey, this is a little bit of something that the client is giving you, or I have something unique to show you, but it's not important to bother you with. In other words, giving them the opportunity to decline. And I've learned that in restaurants. I've learned that in cocktail parties.
Yeah.
And when I take what I've learned and incorporated that into my persona, incorporate that into my psychology at a trade show, yes, it was difficult to stop crowds. I won't lie to anybody. People are at a show for X amount of time, and I didn't want to make this into a whole trade show talk, but it's part of what I used to do. I haven't done a trade show in maybe half a dozen years. The reason is I've just moved on into other venues. Mm-hmm. So would I do another one? Absolutely. It's extremely good money for a lot of hard work.
Well, I've talked with a lot of guys, including Paul Gardner and Harrison Carroll and so many other people who are saying the trade show business is not like what it used to be. And I agree with that as well. It seems like a lot of things that people start to get into the business. And as a result, some of the fees start to go down. It's not as attractive financially as what it once was. Still pretty good, but similar to cruise ships then as well. It's just trade shows are cutting back and they are not booking the magicians the way that they used to then necessarily. So trade shows change and there will be another venue. I mean, they're still good, but not as great as it was.
Well, I don't know how long ago. It was talked about a lot in the early 2000s, where trade shows were going to go viral. In other words, somebody was going to be able to sit in their office and look at all your products while somebody said, you turn this knob, you press this button, and all this wonderful stuff will happen for you. Mm-hmm. And the reason they were talking about it even back then, the cost of executing a trade show was phenomenal. Just the floor space alone. Mm-hmm. You know, Carol Fox used to use a pitch when he was trying to sign a contract, and he would give the client his price, and he'd say, this is how much I cost. Or no, Carol never said how much he costs. When the client said, well, how much is this? Carol would always say, it's less than the floor space you'll be standing on.
Good answer.
And it'll be the most productive thing going on in your booth to be so bold and brazen. Mm-hmm. And that's quite honest. You're not just talking about renting the floor space, putting on the carpeting. You're talking about the booth. You're talking about all of the costs of getting your equipment to the venue, not only just to the venue, but to your actual trade show space. Mm-hmm. You're talking about flying people in, you're putting them up, you're feeding them most of the time. So there are, it's not just, hey, we're going to a trade show. And so by being able to get somebody into your office, whether physically or on a TV monitor, was cutting a lot of costs. Mm-hmm. But everybody realized that the purpose of a trade show is much more than sales and marketing. It was the idea of pressing flesh, shaking right. hands with a potential client, right. shaking hands with a current client and able to look them in the eye and say, thank you. Let me show you what's new. So it's.
Well, a friend of mine, Charlie McFarlane, when he had done his first show and he wasn't sure what to charge, and he said, well, I'll just take a percent. I mean, like, I don't know, 0.5% or whatever it was going to be of any product that a new customer comes back and tells you, I didn't know about this until I heard the magician tell me about this product. And so that way that they could have a direct connection saying this was sold as a result of the magician bringing in this person. And the guy thought, president said, that sounds fair to me. Let's do it. Before a half day was over, he came over and said, we got to renegotiate our deal. He said, why? He said, we just sold a $5 million oil field services thing to this customer, and we're not going to be paying you several hundred thousand dollars right now.
Wow. Well, I wish I knew the name, and I could speculate who I heard this from, but since I'm not at liberty to use the name, I know a couple of guys that in lieu of cash took stock as payment.
Ooh. That's so, a good idea. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, if they don't want to dip into their sugar bowl or their piggy bank,
yep.
You know.
That's smart.
But, I mean, if anything, that shows the faith you have in the company.
That's true.
And it also shows them that
you're invested
you
in them.
Are part of the investment.
Right.
You're not
team.
There just mm-hmm. to take their money. Right. Exactly.
Right. Well, going back then to restaurants, how would you approach a table? In other words, we were talking about the importance of bringing in a crowd and how you kind of approach passersby to bring them into the booth being a difficult part. It's also difficult to walk up in a cocktail party to do your first trick or to introduce yourself, or same thing at a restaurant where people are having a conversation. They could be talking about something very serious, about somebody who just had a cancer diagnosis or somebody who's just celebrating or getting a divorce maybe or whatever. And so you're having to go in and try and liven up that situation or whatever. But is there something you traditionally do as one of your favorite openers?
I really want the group to say no.
Interesting.
And that sounds unusual and maybe even interesting. I would rather be sent away and thought of as the nice guy, because that way their experience at the restaurant is still positive. If I know that once I start entertaining them it's going to be a great experience for him. But until I break that ice for him, there's that uneasiness with the guest. I guess one of my favorite approaches was, hi, my name's Al. I'm here compliments of the management. I do magic, and I make people laugh. You're smiling. You're halfway there. Would you like to see something?
I like that.
It was cute. It was short, and it gave him the opportunity to say no. But see, the hook is I'm here to show you some magic and make you laugh, and you're already smiling. I have just complimented them.
Right.
And yes. When you compliment a person, it does bring out an emotion of happiness.
And how can they say no?
Yeah. I mean, my turndown rate was almost nothing.
I remember Dan Garrett saying, when he would walk up to a group saying, hello, I'm a professional interrupter. How am I doing?
I used to do something like that at cocktail parties. Oh, the line at cocktail parties, and I changed it because it was a negative. But I used to say, I'm paid to bother people, and you're next.
Okay.
You know, if the people were good-natured, they would laugh. And then we'd rock and roll and have a few minutes of fun.
Similarly, I had kind of a negative line for a while when I would go up, and the group was plainly having fun. They were laughing and everything. Said, hey, you guys are having way too much fun. I'm here to bring you all down just a little bit and show you a little magic. I thought it was funny. After the first couple of times, I realized, ooh, I really did bring them down because I set the stage wrong.
that's part of it. We are instilling something negative into something that we are definitely trying to make a positive. And so I don't remember. I haven't done a cocktail party in a while, or at least the cocktail parties I'm working at. I've worked them so many times that now I'm expected. Rather than, hey, who is this guy?
You do the same things. By the way, when you go back to the same company and you do let's say I do Christmas parties, the same company, you know, year after year. Do you do the same repertoire, or do you try to find and learn some new things each year?
Ha!
That's what I thought. I'd be doing the same thing, too. It's like I'm figuring there are new people, or the people who are single are bringing a new date with them or something, and they say, hey, you got to watch this guy. And they remember some of the things I might have done. And so it's the same thing. I mean, year after year, I've got just the regular repertoire.
As far as the walk around, yes, I might have one or two new things. Mm-hmm. You know, I won't call it A material, but it's darn good stuff. And I've always had that concern that, you know, how many times are they going to hire me? And I would share this with Lori, my wife, yep. And she'd say, and she kind of brought me down to my senses. One of my dearest, oldest friends is Jeff Hobson. We're like brothers. We met when we were young teenagers going to Roy Kissel's shop in Detroit, Fox Fun and Magic. And I cannot tell you how many times I've been in the audience with Jeff working in different venues, different shows. Mm-hmm. And Lori, Jeff was opening up in Atlantic City. I was still living back in Detroit, so that's got to be more than 20 years ago. Jeff says, hey, I'm opening up in Atlantic City. Why don't you come out and hang? I said, yeah, sure, I'm not doing anything. I'm a professional magician. So I jumped on an airplane, and I spent, I think, 4 days with him.
Was that when he's doing the Carnival of Wonders with Mark Kalin Jr.?
He was opening up a show called V, and V was a variety show.
I thought V was in Vegas. I didn't know they did
v
that in Atlantic
Vegas,
City.
And they had just started up in Atlantic City, and they wanted him there to kind of open the show. I don't know how long that gig lasted for him, but okay, so I go to Atlantic City. The first night, come on down to the show. I'm sitting in the audience. Okay, fine. Second night, so what are you going to do tonight? He says, yeah. I said, well, I'm going to go to the show. Okay, fine. The third night, he says, you're not really coming to the show again. And I said, yeah, I love it. And he said, but it's the same stuff. I said, I know, Jeff, I do your stuff. I said, I'm not there so much to watch you. I'm there to study the audience. What did you say? How did you say it? And what was their reaction and how strong? And, you know, so I'm like, So Laurie says to me, how many times have you seen Jeff? And truthfully, I can't count that high. And it dawned on me, I love Jeff's egg bag. I love his cards from the mouth. You know, there are a couple of Jeff Hobson moments that I truly enjoy. And I'll sit there over and over. And even though, like I said, I can do the lines, it's just fun. And it made me realize that these clients of mine, that's why they were hiring me. Yeah, they saw me do cigarette through quarter thousands of times.
Sure.
They saw me do invisible deck thousands of times. But yet they knew what I could do for their guests. And quite honestly, Scott, as the years have gone by, I truly feel that some of my long-term clients are hiring me just to have me hang out with them.
And to help create that experience again and the feeling they had from before.
Well, that's what I'm hoping.
Of joy. Mm-hmm.
A dear, well, he's a friend now. I mean, I've only worked for him for, 25 years. It's to the point when they call me up, they don't even ask me how much. They just want to know if I'm available. They know they're going to have to
talking
about. They know they're going to have to fly you in. They know they're going to have to put you up. They know that they're going to give you a nice little bundle of money. So this guy just bought his own company. He moved from one place where he was like the president of the company, ends up buying his own company, and he wants to throw his new group of people a Christmas party. Okay. So he calls me up, asks me if I'm available on the date. I said, yes, I am. I'd love to be there with you. I'm not mentioning any names or any states, not because I'm protecting anyone, but I just don't think it's important. Anyway, so he says to me, well, look, the wife and I have just built a new house, and I know that you like to stay at a certain type of hotel. I know that you fly only United. I know that you don't really care what kind of rent are you carrying. I mean,
you drink Crown Royal.
He's got Crown Royal waiting for him. He says, we've just built a new house. Would you mind staying in our guest wing?
Okay.
Not guest room, not guest suite.
Yeah.
Our guest wing.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this is the most unpretentious man in the world. He started out as the blue light special guy at Kmart, and anybody under the age of 40 has no idea what I've just said. But in college, that was his job. And now he has, after being the president of a huge corporation, now owns his own. And, I know he just loves my company. And like you alluded to, absolutely. They could love you as much as they want, but if you don't produce for them, forget it.
Well, that brings me to the story about something where you had influenced me greatly, where I had a client, still have a client that I use, who had booked me in different places around the country, from New York to L.A. and around, as well as, of course, throughout Houston. But I was up in Chicago or Detroit there, and I stayed with you and Laurie and Hamtramck. And at the time, back then, I was reluctant to charge too much for this to this client. And then you had asked me about how much I was getting, and I told you, and they said, well, the cost of your flight and everything else that you're paying for your expenses and whatnot is more than what your fee is. And you should be charging at least, maybe double that, and maybe start thinking about that. Cause I'd never thought in these higher levels of what I should be charging and what my services were valued, what they should be worth. Basically, after I got back, I never look back. I never charged less than that. It's either I want this or I don't have to work for you. So it in they respected that. And anyhow, aside from them, everybody else is what I've been, thanks to you, been doing very well financially working in Magic as far as what I charge for shows. Prior to me visiting with you and Laurie, I was in signing your guest book. I had not.
It was handy. I could tell you what date it was.
You probably can. I have never looked back since then. It's kind of like,
well, thank you.
Yeah, you really changed my financial career, and I appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate that. I want to interject. I'm sure it has to do. I had four mentors. Well, kind of five. My first mentor was Roy Kissel, his magic shop. My second mentor was Ken and Roberta Griffin. Roberta was the business end of the Ken Griffin show. Then came Dick Ryan. And after Dick Ryan, was Jerry Conklin. Each one influenced me in different ways. But I think the thread that connected the four of them was, this is a business. If you don't work this as a business, you will be doing something else for a living, which is not a bad thing. As a matter of fact, I am jealous over some friends who are now retiring, but then I don't really have anything to retire from. In other words,
most magicians don't retire.
I'm having a great time.
Sure.
You know, as long as the dear Lord blesses me with health and a gift of gab, I'm ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And since it's a business, okay, you know, maybe a salesperson makes X amount of dollars a year. Let's just pick $70,000.
Okay.
And you want $10,000 to do a four-day show.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can break that $10,000 up anyway. It could be $10,000 in your pocket because they're taking care of all of your expenses, or that could be an all-inclusive fee that includes you paying for a hotel, airfare, rent a car, whatever.
Right.
But let's just go with $10,000. So you are making a seventh of what a guy who's working with them all year makes.
Mm-hmm.
But because of what you give them in the time you spend with them, now all of a sudden it's not that expensive, especially since they have just flown in 20 of their people, one from Cleveland, one from Des Moines, Iowa, three of them from Los Angeles, a couple of them from Florida. In the big picture of what's being spent, to us, whatever we charge may sound like a lot of money. But in their world, it's just part of doing business.
Correct.
And I don't know if I so eloquently described that to you 40, 30, whatever years ago. But and then, of course, there's people who just won't pay you no matter what you charge.
You need to look for the ones who value you and forget about those who don't.
Roy Kissel taught me you can always take money away. You can never add. Now, that's not saying that there aren't add-ons. It's not saying there isn't back-of-the-room sales. There's a lot of ways to increase your income. But the point is, if I tell you I want $10 and you say, well, that's okay, I can't come back to you and say, well, let's make it $11.
Exactly. Yeah, good point.
You might come back to me and say, well, look, Al, we only have $7. Now, it's my decision as to whether it's worth my time, my energy, if I have the time. I mean, everything is negotiable.
Mm-hmm.
But I would rather start at the little bit more than what I would like and come down to what I'd like. I have a theory. I'm going to share this. And it's not new to me, but it's something that I've come up
with. Okay.
As a human being, has nothing to do with entertainment. I need a new roof put on my garage. Most people, if they have a friend, they have their roof done. Other people will go out and get three different bids, and depending on what they are sold, will make a determination. I have a feeling that there is a magic number. You've got $5,000. You're willing? I'll have a drink with you. Excuse me.
You can hear that.
Yes, thank you. My ice is melted, so you can't hear mine. Anyway, so you have a magic number. You've got $5,000 to put a roof on your garage. So somebody bids you a price of $2,000. Well, okay, thank you.
Yeah.
And then you've got somebody who bids you $10,000. Well, holy crap, are those shingles gold lined? And then there's somebody who quotes you, let's say, $6,000. Now, it's $1,000 more than what you had budgeted. But if this guy is $6,000, the other guy is $10,000, and the first guy was $2,000, maybe that $2,000 guy isn't quite what I would want to do my job.
Just because he's the lowest bidder, right?
Correct. So I have this theory. I have this that middle wins. And to be able to be my own competitor, I try and sell a client three packages. The middle package is the amount of money I really want to get. I want $3,500 plus all expenses to go out and do a 40-minute stand-up.
Okay.
Sometimes the airfare, especially from Hawaii, could be $1,000 or more.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm flying in from Cleveland to, let's say, Orlando, I charge him the airfare from Cleveland to Orlando. Carol Fox taught me this a lot of years ago. He said you can shear a sheep once a year, but you can only skin it once.
Good advice. I understand that.
I never take advantage of a client because I don't like being taken advantage. But we go back to my principle of the middle. You have just hired the guy to do your garage roof because, number one, he was close to what you wanted to spend. And that $10,000 guy, my gosh, what the hell is he using? And that $2,000 guy, he probably works for his brother-in-law and doesn't really need the money and probably won't care how he does a job. Okay. So as an entertainer, as a professional, I offer clients three packages. With the middle package being what I would really like to make on the gig.
Mm-hmm.
The first package is your basic, this, that, and the other. The second, let's use some money. Okay. The first package is $2,000, which may include my own travel, which will knock that down maybe $750. So I'm actually coming home with $1,250. The second package is $3,500 plus all expenses. And I'm being honest about what I'm trying to get. I'm not telling everyone who's listening that this is what I get.
Yeah, sure.
Because I will still go out and do a gig for $100. Let's be honest.
We love doing it.
I mean, especially if it's some, somebody down the street saying, hey, I know you're a magician. We're doing something for the kids. And I walk over there with 20 minutes in my pocket. Or sometimes I'll do a free show and I'll accept a $100 tip.
Mm-hmm.
The most I've ever been tipped was $500, but that's a whole nother story. Okay, so for the first one, for $2,000, I'll do your cocktail party. For the $3,500 one, I will do the after dinner show. But I've got I think the third package is $5,000,
which includes walk around.
Walk around and the stage.
And the show.
Oh, and I may even say for $10,000, I'll do a major illusion where I have to hire an assistant and we need some staging and lighting. The staging and lighting you'll have to pay for. Well, the person I'm talking to doesn't want to call up the local
union
or the local AV department to rent all this crap. So I know they're not going to take the big package. It's
right.
Because I'm making it trouble for them.
Yes. You want to make it as hassle-free, and so that's what they're thinking, and they've got a couple of things that they can look at rather than just a price. They can look at a price list.
So instead of them having to call four different entertainers, and by entertainers, my competition is not – and I've got a great story about why I feel this way. My competition is not a magician. My competition is an AV department. My competition is a juggler, a ventriloquist, a mime, a mentalist. Because when these companies are trying to book something for their event.
Or DJs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Live bands. Geez,
how many times have you lost a gig because they decided, oh, we're just going to go with the DJ?
Yeah.
Ha!
Yeah.
Good point. I try to be my own competition by giving them different scenarios. And I hope they land in the center where I want to be. Now, let's say they decide that they want, okay, so walk around is $2,000, stand up is $3,500, combination of the two is $5,000, big shot with an illusion show with an illusion or two is 10. Again, I mentioned this earlier. I want $3,500. Well, we really like this and we really like that. You know, Scott, I'm going to be there anyway. Tell you what, for $3,500, I'll do the close-up during your cocktails and your stage, and we'll be doing business 20 years from now together.
Sold. Sounds like a great deal. It's a win-win.
There you go. Yep. They don't have to call all the other entertainers or all the other sideshow. I have to understand that they are budgeted. I have to understand what they're trying to accomplish. They're not trying to accomplish having a magician. They're trying to accomplish showing their guests, their employees, their vendors, their investors, a nice evening.
But not only that, they need to go back to their boss and say, I negotiated a good deal.
Yeah.
I was started with this, and he also gave me this for no additional cost. So I think we won. So they have to feel good about what they're buying. Rather than just taking this price list back, they can actually go back and say, well, I negotiated a better deal.
Yep.
Yeah. Before we finish, one of the things I'd like to talk about, I mentioned at the beginning, and that is that you are the curator or kind of the guide, if you will, the cemetery guide in Colon, because there are so many magicians who have been buried there. As I understand, people are dying to get in. So it's and also you put together the book, which is the ultimate book on the, what's it called, the graveyard?
The Magic Graveyard.
There you go.
Thank you.
And there are new people who are coming in all the time. In fact, I just recently had purchased a plot next to Walter Blaney and behind Phil Wilmarth and near David Lindsell in that area then as well. So eventually I will be there too. So anyhow, tell me, so when you do that, that is an annual thing that you actually do this tour, and then you've got the book that kind of obviously continues to grow with different chapters as people die.
The last edition was 2019. I am really pushing myself to have a 2021 edition out. I don't know whether I'll be able to meet my deadline because currently I have three new chapters to add to the book with the possibility of five.
Wow.
Not that we're expecting two more people to die. These are people who have actually passed, but the family has now decided that they will be interred, the ashes will be interred at Lakeside. So three chapters for sure, a possibility of five. I've got 4 months to do this.
Before Abbott's.
That's a deadline in order to have it ready for Abbott's. So the way the tour began was because, you know, I keep mentioning a couple of names. And the reason I keep mentioning these names is I became very close with these people and they were very influential. And of course, I'm talking about Carol Fox at this point. On Friday nights of the get together, Carol would take J. Marshall, Ab Dixon, a host of others would go out to the cemetery and they would sit around Duke Stern's grave and they would tell Dookie stories. Dookie died in 1973.
While they're having a little bit of alcohol.
Well, there were spirits that were always there, and there were sometimes we shot off fireworks and other times we just a little candle, but it was always a hoot and a lot of tears. And every year, Carol would invite a couple of young guys to sit in so that these stories would never be forgotten. And I was very honored to be invited multiple times to the point where I was a regular. Well, okay, so years go by, and there was a TV crew in Colon, and Carol wanted to go out to the cemetery, and he would stop off at certain gravestones and tell stories. Well, my best buddy, Jeff Bibick, and I happened to be in the right spot at the right time, and Carol said, come on, kids, we're going to the cemetery. So I think you can purchase the videotape, or actually it's a download now from Mary Itted, and Carol goes and tells stories about each one, and that was kind of the impetus of the tour. So Carol Fox passes away. If I had all the information in front of me, I could give you the actual dates. Carol passes, and my dear friend Jerry Conklin started taking us out at midnight, but not like Carol, where we sat by Duke's grave, Jerry would actually walk the cemetery, and we would stop at each gravesite, say a little prayer, and whoever had any information about that person would share it. Mm-hmm. Some of the information will die with me. Okay, but that's a sidebar. So,
interesting. And so you continue to do that. Of course, now it's not during the evening. It's now something that people do during the daytime out there.
Well, 10 years ago, my dear friend Hank Morehouse said, you know, Al, when Carol took you and Bibbick out to that cemetery, he was actually passing the mantle.
Hmm, true.
It's your responsibility to tell these stories. And it kind of hit me like a brick that, wow, I'm honored. I'm flattered. And what they did is they put it as an afternoon lecture on site at the cemetery. And that's how the tour started. Well, the first year or two, I had notes, and there were only 20-some magicians buried at the cemetery at the time. And I was able to get to all of the burial sites within an hour. We are now at 40 or more. And of the headstones that are there, there's only 3 people who are not buried there currently. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so even though I sat in on those midnight sessions, even though I took every midnight tour with Jerry on Friday nights, when it was turned over to me, I realized that I was forgetting a lot of the detail. So I started writing down notes, and these notes were going to turn into lecture notes. And I thought, well, you know, I'll sell them for $5 a piece. This will pay for all my meals during the week in Colon, because you can eat rather cheaply.
Right.
And if not the meals, it might also include a nice round of Crown Royal at the American Legion. So I thought, okay, lecture notes. Then the lecture note idea turned into a hip pocketbook, you know, the type you buy at you buy at the grocery store as you're paying for all of your groceries.
Like little astrology things and whatnot.
Yeah. Hmm. And all of a sudden, this grew up into a book. The first book was printed in 2014. That was the first edition. And now when I look back at the 2014 edition, what I have found is I've made a lot of historical mistakes. And it's not so much that I made the mistakes, it's the research I did gave me information that is not completely accurate.
Interesting.
You know, and I say this on the tour. They say, believe only half of what you see, nothing of what you hear, but if it's engraved in stone, it must be true. Well, Jack Wynn's headstone says that he and Anne were married on a certain date.
Okay.
Year, date and year. Well, the year they would have been juniors in high school. They did not elope until 2 years after that date on their headstone.
That's interesting.
I immediately called my dear friend Beth Floker down in Florida. She is Jack's granddaughter. Mm-hmm. She said, Al, you're the only person who's ever noticed that. Well, the reason I noticed that is because I consider myself a historian, and I have to be factual in my writing. And I called up our dear friend Dave Charvet.
Charvet.
Yeah. I mean, he's the biographer of the Gwynns. And David said, Al, you're absolutely correct. So you see, if you open up an issue of the Linking Ring, it may say a story about an individual, whereas in the MUM, the story might be he was not in Cleveland, he was in Buffalo. And then if you go on one of the ancestry-type sites, I don't know how much time I get. We can do an entire hour on this. I just found out that Fred R. Merle is not Fred R. Merle.
Okay.
Fred R. Merle worked. I've got a whole history of him. I wrote the book. I have 3 different government documents, birth certificate, application for draft, and certificate of death. And on each 3, he has a different name. I called his daughter, Marilyn Merle, who lives in California. She's in her mid-80s. Delightful lady. I said, can you clarify this for me? And she gives me a fourth name.
Confuse matters even more. Yeah.
Exactly. Hmm. So as a historian, I need to put all that into that chapter.
Yeah.
Which is very time consuming. And as soon as I add an additional page to the book, all of my indices are skewed.
So the book that you put together obviously changed from year to year as more people come into the cemetery. Do you sell the book complete with from the beginning to end? I mean, just add more to it, and then you have to resell that, or do you sell like a part two or something, or what have you been thinking? How are you going to market that?
I'm thinking of going into a two-volume set.
Mm-hmm.
I am overwhelmed of the success of the book. I am grateful that I am able to save these stories. And I think and that was something that Carol instilled in me without knowing it, mm-hmm. or maybe on purpose and hoping I would catch on, is that these stories can't be forgotten.
That's right. That's great.
They're very important. Yeah. Yeah. As our generation phases out, the next generation will have even less knowledge of some of these people, and the generation after that won't have any knowledge of these people.
Unless they may be, your book includes all that information.
Well, exactly.
Right.
The way I describe this is, if I asked you to tell me something about your great-great-grandfather, most of us would be remiss in not knowing anything about that individual. And here is our bloodline.
Mm-hmm. Good point. So if people want to buy a book or to get some more information on this, where can they go to find this?
AbbottMagic.com. Obviously, you can get it on Amazon. The 2019 edition, which is the current edition, has been revised. And what causes a revision is somebody tells me an awesome story about a person that I feel should be told, or I find a picture of a person that probably isn't in the mainstream magic books. For instance, I just found a wonderful story about Harry Blackstone Jr.'s first appearance on a stage. It is such a delight. I mean, he was a newborn. He was an infant, several months old, not a newborn. He was an infant, but less than a year old when he made his first appearance on the stage. And it's just a cute story of how his mom snuck him out on stage because she had to. There was no babysitter available to keep him off in the wings. So she just appeared with him inside an illusion. So I think a story like, I try and keep this interesting,
sure,
lighthearted, and entertaining.
Well, people love stories, just as you have shared several of them here during this last hour, and it's just been marvelous. And I thank you very much. And I think this book, again, is something people should have on their shelves, and it's a part of not only the legacy of those who are in the cemetery, but it's just something that goes to the texture that is the fabric of our magic tapestry that makes it
thank
so
you.
Beautiful that we
the
all
magic graveyard.
Need to know more about that. Magic Graveyard, and that's at AbbottMagic.com. So as we start to close here, or as I finish, actually, I always like to ask my guest what your magic word is, as you know, because we've been friends. You've heard me ask others. You've been around as I've recorded these podcasts with others. So what is your philosophy of life? What is it? I know that changes from time to time. So whatever you may have had even in the past is different than what you've had now. So what's important to you? What's your magic
as
word?
As simple as it sounds, I try to treat people the way I want to be treated. Because I enjoy being spoiled. I enjoy being praised. I enjoy when somebody makes my life a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. And I think as a human being, the bottom line is we want people to take interest in us. It could be a thank you for doing this for me. It could be a box of chocolate or a dozen roses because you helped me get a client or whatever. Mm-hmm. If I sometimes am overly appreciative of people, because if it wasn't for people being nice to me, I would not be able to accomplish the things I've done. Mm-hmm. I just try and be nice. I mean, there's a lot of people I don't agree with. There's a lot of people who are polar opposites on a lot of different topics.
Sure.
But just because we don't agree on something doesn't mean we can't enjoy each other's company. You know, I'm sorry that social media has separated all of us. Back in the early days, we sat at a table because we could do a double lift. We used to be able to laugh because we were able to fool somebody with a French drop.
Right.
That was the extent of our problems back then. Mm-hmm. We didn't care who was in office. We didn't care what the politics were. We cared for each other because we all loved magic. In the bigger picture, and I talk to this at the kids, be kind, be nice. And it's something our parents have always told us. If we can't say something nice about somebody, don't say anything.
Yeah,
and it's that simple. I mean, it's so simple that I think it passes a lot of us by.
That's true. It's very fundamental. Well, this has been great. Absolutely wonderful, Al. I appreciate every moment I always get to spend with you. And this, I was going to say an hour, it's flown by so very quickly. Oh, my goodness. I appreciate the time we've had here. Look forward to us getting together and spending some time we can actually enjoy. I'll buy you a crown. You can buy me one.
I'll buy you a martini, my friend. A cocotini. A cocotini.
There we go.
My
love
friend,
you, man.
I love you too. We've had a lot of wonderful years together and memories that have been made, and I can't wait till
can't
you
wait
and
to play
I
a little eat. Golf at the Colon Open that you always host every year there too. That's
let's do
thing.
It.
So until next time, that was Al the Only, and this is Scotty out. Wow, what a great one. Thank you ever so much, Al. I appreciate you being our guest this week on the Magic Word Podcast. The wisdom and tips you had shared are invaluable, and people are really getting their money's worth, more than their money's worth, certainly with this episode. So thanks again. And they're also going to be getting an opportunity to win a book. That's right. I told you at the first of this podcast, I'll tell you a little bit more information on the back end. Well, if you go to themagicwordpodcast.com for this week's episode, number 606, there you will see an entry form where you put in your name and email address, and you will have an opportunity then for a chance to win a copy of The Magic Graveyard by Al the Only. This is going to be a hard copy book, and I say hard copy, it's a physical book, I should say, because it is actually a softbound edition, but it is a physical edition and not a PDF, which means, therefore, it is limited to those who live domestically here in the United States, because domestic postage will be covered by Al. If you are overseas or outside the United States and it's going to require foreign postage and you decide that you want to enter and your name is randomly selected, then you will be given the opportunity to reimburse for foreign postage once it's determined how much that is. And if you agree to pay for it, fine. And if not, then we will go and draw another winner. So, again, just go and check that out for an opportunity to win a copy of The Magic Graveyard. Well, this has been, again, just an episode chock full of a lot of information from start to finish. I hope that you guys have enjoyed this half as much as I have, which means I've enjoyed it twice as much as you. I certainly have been getting a lot out of this, an opportunity to share some good times with friends and also to share these good times with you, my good friends and listeners. And I thank you for coming back from week to week. Please, if you will, share the word. Tell other magicians about this podcast who may not yet have heard about this. There are over 600 episodes in the archives. You can go back and listen to anything you want to listen to for free. You can do a search for anyone's name or a topic, and you can probably find it there and hear a little bit more about that in the archives. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to be kind, be nice. And if you can't say something nice about someone, well, then don't say anything at all.
This is Scotty out.